You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Hollywood 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. A boom of their own. Furious over the marginalization of women in film, indie director Alison Anders convened a summit, part suffragette rally, part catharsis, part 60-hour sleepover, at the Miramar Hotel in Santa Barbara in April 2000. The ripple effects of that gathering and its 50-50 manifesto continue to spread today, even as a new movement rocks the industry. Carrie Beauchamp, who was there that weekend, hears from many other attendees about the epiphanies that the conclave inspired. Opening photograph by Art Streiber. And pictured here are Nina Menke's filmmaker, Marina Zinovich, documentary filmmaker, Donna Deitch, director, Martha Little, writer-producer, Colette Burson, writer-director, Susan Glatzer, documentary filmmaker, Robin Alper, writer-entrepreneur, Margot Gerber, film marketer, Michelle Satter, founding director, Sundance Labs, Lisa Cotin, writer-performer, Elizabeth Stanley, producer, Kristen Borella, publicist, Maya Smuckler, film historian, Tamara Davis, director, Angela Robinson, director, Shana Eddy, executive, Alison Anders, director, Jody Kahn, negotiation consultant, Tara Venaruso, director, Victoria Hochberg, director, Martha Coolidge, director, Gwen Nguyen, director, Andrea Sperling, producer, Carrie Beauchamp, writer, Jamie Babbitt, director. Styled by Sharon Williams, hair and makeup by Samantha Freiling, Christina Guerra and Juanita Lyon. Set design by Anthony A. Altimar. Produced on location by Allison Elioff. And the group is shown on the backstage of a movie set. The idea to convene a summit of women filmmakers was an informal, modest one, yet it was born of a deep-seated frustration. And it all began because Alison Anders was pissed. It was late 1999, and Anders, the indie film director, Gas Food Lodging, Grace of My Heart, and a MacArthur Genius Fellow, saw women being isolated and marginalized. Why did they have such trouble getting their movies produced? Why were men, after a flop, allowed to fail upward? But if a woman's film was successful, it was viewed as an aberration. And why didn't women in Hollywood know about the female pioneers who had shaped the business? Anders was devastated when she learned that Dorothy Davenport Reed, an acclaimed director in the 1920s, had died in obscurity 50 years later, practically in my backyard in Woodland Hills, Anders now recalls. Dorothy Davenport had not been alone. At Cinema's dawn, dozens of female directors flourished in Hollywood, where they supported one another both personally and professionally. Before 1925, almost half of all films were written by women. And yet, they had risen at a time when film wasn't taken seriously as a business. Once talkies arrived in the late 20s, budgets soon tripled, Wall Street invested heavily, and movie-making became an industry. Men muscled into high-paying positions, and women were sidelined to the point where, by the 1950s, speakers at Directors Guild meetings began their comments with "Gentlemen and Miss Lupino," as Ida Lupino was their only female member. Anders appreciated the potential power of the camaraderie to be found among fellow creative souls, and so she emailed a dozen friends asking if they felt the same way. If so, what would they think of getting together, each paying her own way, to spend a weekend hashing out their concerns, strategizing, and talking about, as she put it, what needs to happen next? Her idea touched a nerve, and in April of 2000, more than 100 women showed up for what was billed as the Women Filmmakers Summit, held at the Miramar, a run-down but still vibrant hotel between the Pacific and the railroad tracks in Santa Barbara. The rooms shook when trains went by. Anders knew Miramar by the sea as a magical place where she occasionally holed up to write. It was on the beach, had a large conference room, and Anders secured a slight group discount. The Miramar itself is long gone. A developer is opening a luxury hotel there this year, but that weekend still unites those who attended, and the impact of the conclave continues to ripple out in ways that few people in Hollywood realize. Allison Anders, an innate collaborator, drew together an organically diverse and multi-generational group. Some of the women were friends. Most knew of one another only by reputation. And for many, this was the first time they had come together without the support of a guild or association. The excitement was palpable and uniquely female, part reunion, part suffragette rally, part 60-hour sleepover. Maya Smuckler, then working at Women Make Movies in New York, enlisted participants from the East Coast. Next photos, paving the way. Director Dorothy Arzner with Clara Bow, who starred in Arzner's The Wild Party, 1929, and Ida Lupino directing an episode of CBS's Hotel de Paris, 1959. Publicist Kristen Barella greeted everyone upon arrival with name tags, an agenda, short bios, and Anders' original letter tucked inside a green paper folder like the ones used to turn in middle school reports. And what a packed agenda it was! Friday afternoon and evening were set aside for what Anders presumed would be a very sloppy and loose venting session. The mantra, as she recalls, was, "We are not victims, we are survivors." There was so much anger from devastating disappointments and being effed over, and a general feeling of injustice. Everyone crammed into the minimalist main room with its coastal white and blue decor. Some sat around tables decorated with bouquets of sweet peas. Others stood against the walls. Most stayed late, watching the Wild Party, starring Clara Bow and directed by Dorothy Arzner, who, among her many accomplishments, is one of those credited with inventing the boom mic. As a writer of film history, I was asked to provide a primer on the women of early Hollywood and bring along some VHS tapes of films by our foremothers. Saturday was billed as a day of solutions. After breakfast, speakers chaired a series of discussions at half-hour intervals, covering almost every aspect of the professional challenges women faced. The audience did as much talking as the moderators. There was a sense that this was a safe space, and the candor was stunning. One woman told the crowd, "I don't want to make small films. I want to direct epics." Another piped in, "I've been in at least 10 interviews where it was down to two of us, and every time the job went to the white male." Some veterans were on hand, such as Polly Platt, whose visual acumen shaped her ex-husband Peter Bogdanovich's movies, and who had begun to nurture filmmakers such as Wes Anderson. Martha Coolidge had worked consistently since her first hit, Valley Girl, in 1983, and she was fresh from completing her groundbreaking television film, Introducing Dorothy Dandridge, written by a then-unknown Shonda Rhimes, and establishing Halle Berry as an actress to be reckoned with. Victoria Hochberg, one of the filmmakers responsible for the 1983 Directors Guild lawsuit against several studios for failure to hire women, and director Donna Deitch, Desert Hearts, the women of Brewster Place, spoke of their struggles. Maggie Renzi, who first made it to the big screen, producing and acting alongside John Sayles in their seminal film Return of the Secaucus Seven, had produced a dozen pictures, including Girl Fight, by her former assistant Karen Kusama. Renzi had come to Miramar at the encouragement of director Nancy Savoca, who had just won the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance for her first feature, True Love. Along with other directors such as Tamara Davis, Billy Madison, Sarah Jacobson, Mary Jane's Not a Virgin Anymore, Colette Burson, coming soon, and Gurinder Chadha, Bend It Like Beckham, was a smattering of critics such as Manola Dargis, then writing for L.A. Weekly, chick flicks author B. Ruby Rich, agents like Shayna Eddy, as well as executives, producers, and actresses, including Marianne Lyon, Marina Zinovich, and Marianne Jean-Baptiste, all looking to expand into writing, directing, or producing. There were also documentarians and representatives from various film organizations. A handful of men were welcomed, but only on Saturday. They did not spend the night. Then there were the young upstarts, among them Patricia Cardoso, who is the water carrier of Cucanumba, had won a Student Academy Award, Jamie Babbitt, who had recently finished But I'm a Cheerleader, and Andrea Sperling, one of the producers of Babbitt's film. Babbitt arrived with Angela Robinson, just out of NYU Film School, who remembers, "We tiptoed into this room full of powerful women. We were, wow, here were real live women directors, our indie heroes." Many of the women considered themselves strong and outspoken, but few could compare to Sarah Jacobson, the activist proponent of DIY filmmaking, who that Saturday, with a huge smile on her face, called on the assembled to begin effing shit up. It became a bit of a free-for-all, but never spun out of control. Woman after woman, across three generations, told tales of hurdles and harassment and dreams dashed. Situations that, until then, many had thought that they alone had experienced. The confessions, helpful hints, and debates continued over long walks beside the gentle surf or back in the hotel rooms, and there was a gradual, cathartic realization that the walls they were up against weren't personal, but systemic. Almost everyone remained through Sunday, breaking into groups on the beach to discuss next steps. One of the immediate conclusions was that they would need a name. When Sarah Jacobson shouted out the Pussy Whippers, Renzi responded that could be one faction. In the end, they settled on 50-50, summarizing their inclusionary goal. Their other mandate, to continue meeting. And as more women joined their ranks over the next few months, their forces expanded. 50-50 gatherings were held at various homes in New York and L.A., and at Martha Coolidge's ranch in the San Fernando Valley, where everyone sat memorably on bales of hay. In keeping with the anonymity insisted upon by the Guerrilla Girls, feminist artists who blend humor and outrage as they expose gender inequality, a dozen or so of the Miramar women joined forces with them. Their first collaboration appeared the following year at Sundance, with witty yet biting slogans on stickers posted all over town, bearing messages such as, "These distributors don't know how to pick up women," listing companies whose rosters lacked female-directed features. Next came a rather joyous action that required real fundraising. A billboard trumpeting the anatomically correct Oscar. He's white and male, just like the guys who win. Placed strategically on Highland Avenue in Hollywood, so that people on their way to the 2002 Academy Awards would be sure to see it, the billboard received international press coverage. There was no social media to carry through with an hashtag OscarSoMale campaign. That same year, Miramar alum Martha Coolidge was elected president of the Directors Guild. Women were ecstatic, as were younger, minority, gay, and lesbian directors who had long felt marginalized. But while Coolidge declines to address that period and still works with the DGA, it was no secret her efforts to effect change were hampered by a certain segment of entrenched power at the Guild. She served for a year and remains the only woman to have held that post. Without staff or funding, and with the pressing demands of life and work, the 50-50 meetings fell off, but loose-knit connections remained, aided by dial-up email. And that community, says Coolidge, gave rise to all these new communities now. Many a young woman in the film trade, upon encountering someone from the group, has been heard to remark with awe, "You were at Miramar?" Currently, there is a bustling connectivity that evolved in part from the Miramar ethos. For several years, director and editor Tara Vinaruso maintained a post-summit support and information website called The First Weekend, because a film's fate at the box office in that pre-streaming era was determined in the days right after its release. 10 years ago, Melissa Silverstein began her weekly online update, Women and Hollywood, listing films directed by and about women, along with news and interviews. Over time, film festivals such as Athena at Barnard, Citizen Jane at Stevens College in Missouri, and PowFest in Oregon have come to provide invaluable forums for female directors. Today, there are the Women's Writing and Directing Labs at Sundance and the AFI Conservatory Directing Workshop for Women, both of which feature Miramar alum members and mentors. Film Fatale is a grassroots organization for women who have directed at least one feature, with 500 members throughout the world. Female cinematographers and composers, two of the fields where women are most drastically underrepresented, have their own associations. Then there are the quantifiers, academics who analyze the hard data on male dominance in movies, led by the woman who has been doing it for more than 20 years, Martha Lauzon and her Center for the Study of Women in Television and Film. Full disclosure, I serve on the advisory board. Their annual studies, such as the celluloid ceiling and boxed in, reveal the shocking and continuing lack of women both in front of and behind the camera. In 1998, 9% of the top 250 films were directed by women. In 2016, it was 7%. What remains unquantifiable are the films not made, the stories not told, and the careers ended early because of discouragement or harassment. It is also impossible to compute the number of hours not wasted on angst or self-doubt because of the openness and support of other women. Nearly two decades later, the friendships forged that weekend are still a crucial part of many of the attendees' lives and careers. "Ever since, as one woman explains, I haven't felt alone." Says another, "After the summit, I stopped asking permission." And yet another, "It opened my eyes to a lot of things that were hiding in plain sight, and from then on I have had a different perspective." Director Colette Burson says that weekend appeared like an oasis in the desert, and the call for 50-50 inspired her to reach that goal for women directors on her series Hung. Angela Robinson, who most recently directed Professor Marston and The Wonder Women, says, "I think about Miramar all the time. I thought I was ready to take on the world, but it quickly became clear that day, with so much emotion in the room and all the stories of what they were up against, that it was a mountain to scale. In particular, I think about one director who stood up and said, 'Every time I walk through a studio door, There is a white man on the other side, and I see him immediately try to put me in a box. Mother, wife, daughter, or whore. Those are the categories they chose from to relate to me. With a laugh, Robinson explains why she passes that lesson on to the students she now teaches, and why it made such a difference to her. Because I am black and gay, when I walk through that studio door, there are still white men on the other side, but they are confused. I use that confusion to start pitching so fast, they latch on to the ideas before they can figure out what box to put me in. As is to be expected, the participants at Miramar have gone on to experience everything from a heartbreaking lack of work to incredible success. After directing Real Women Have Curves in 2002, Cardoso has just completed her second feature. Babbitt is currently directing Silicon Valley. Coolidge teaches at Orange County's Chapman University, where her students have gone on to garner awards. Anders, after years of directing series such as Riverdale and Orange is the New Black, is a distinguished professor in film and media studies at UC Santa Barbara. Shonda Rhimes, who attended follow-up 50-50 sessions, is, well, Shonda Rhimes. And Manola Dargis, now a New York Times critic, notes that even though today's directors, such as Ava DuVernay, Patty Jenkins, and Catherine Bigelow are heralded, they are still unicorns. 18 years after Miramar, the latest community of women to emerge, to find life-changing strength from standing together and speaking out, is comprised of all those who have been breaking their silence about hashtag MeToo. Journalists ruptured the dam, but social media and a newly energized group of determined women created the tsunami that may yet bring about genuine change. In January, more than 300 prominent women from the film industry launched Time's Up, a multi-pronged approach to combating sexual harassment, on the heels of a new commission headed by Anita Hill. Andrea Sperling, now Jill Soloway's producing partner, responsible for Transparent and I Love Dick, has been in those recent meetings with Real Power in the Room and reports that they are having long conversations seeking concrete solutions. She adds, I have been thinking about Miramar and 50-50 because one of the goals being discussed is 50-50 by 2020. When asked what she thinks is going to happen next, she responds with the same humor-tinged optimism that permeated that long-ago weekend. The patriarchy is toppling as we speak. Krista Smith writes this Vanity Fair spotlight, Breakfast at Tiffany's. Photograph by Mark Seliger. Tiffany Haddish with toy poodles Jackson and Spencer at JoJo, a restaurant in New York City. My goal is to make 80 movies by the time I'm 50, so I have 12 years to make it happen, actress and comedian Tiffany Haddish says with a laugh. She is off to an impressive start. Her breakout role as Dina in the film Girls Trip earned her a Best Supporting Actress award from the New York Film Critics Circle, and she has 3 more movies in the pipeline, including the forthcoming Night School with longtime buddy Kevin Hart. Recently, she has also hosted Saturday Night Live, published a best-selling book of essays called The Last Black Unicorn, and embarked on a national stand-up tour. But Haddish's childhood was no laughing matter. She watched her mother descend into mental illness and entered the Los Angeles foster care system at age 12. When you got a mom and dad or one person believing in you as a kid, it's easy to succeed in school, in sports. But when you don't have that, you have to do it yourself. Haddish says she read and watched a lot of inspirational YouTube videos. It changed my whole existence. When she was 15, her social worker, who had noticed that Haddish was getting into trouble in school, encouraged her to attend the Laugh Factory camp, where Haddish found her voice. She started doing stand-up anywhere she could. I felt like at the comedy club, I would set myself apart from other women and just talk like a man. They always used to tell me, like, you're too dirty, you're too dirty. I was doing bar mitzvahs, too, but everybody didn't know that, she adds. I was very clean at the mitzvahs. Now that she has achieved the financial stability she never had as a kid, Haddish has some new goals. I want to be baby Oprah. I want to build a youth center, a mental health center, and a job placement center. I would like to be able to buy 2 streets that intersect and call it Tiffany and Haddish. the happiest man in showbiz. 4 decades ago, Eric Roberts was poised to be Hollywood's next big star. Today, he's a journeyman actor, doing as many movies as he can, 74 last year alone, and enjoying every one. Examining what kept Roberts from the meteoric path of his sister, Julia, Sam Cashner discovers that for a new generation, the hardest-working man in Hollywood has become something of a legend. Photographs by Sam Jones. Opening photo, actor to watch, Eric Roberts in Santa Monica, California. On a baking hot day in Glendora in the San Gabriel Valley, 23 miles from downtown Los Angeles, Eric Roberts is trying to straighten his tie. His director, Doug Campbell, blocks a pivotal scene in the hallway of Citrus College, in which Eric, playing the predatory Dr. Beck, is confronted by one of his medical school students. She barges into his classroom and throws him against the blackboard. In the rehearsal, Eric looks genuinely surprised. "Whoa, you scared me, honey." The movie is stalked by My Doctor 3. The third installment in the popular Lifetime franchise, it marks Eric's 74th movie role just last year alone. As of this writing, he's credited with 487 film and television appearances. In fact, he may well be considered for inclusion in Guinness World Records as the American actor with the most film credits. The current world title holder, the comedic Telugu film actor Brahmamandaman Kaniganti, known for his hilarious facial expressions, clinched that record in 2010 with 857 screen appearances. There are times when Eric does 3 movies in one day, literally racing from one indie set to another. Some days are so ridiculous as to be almost sublime, as when he acted simultaneously in Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight and in Witless Protection with Larry the Cable Guy. So you need a lot of bandwidth to prowl through Eric's filmography on IMDb. In truth, Roberts is in front of a camera nearly every day of his life. Like one of Hamlet's players, he's an itinerant actor wandering the countryside looking for any stage. He's been in mainstream television shows, such as Grey's Anatomy and CSI Crime Scene Investigation. But in the last 3 decades, most of his television shows and movies have had titles such as Sorority Slaughterhouse, Hansel and Gretel, Warriors of Witchcraft, Cowboys vs. Dinosaurs, Sicilian Vampire, and Snow White, A Deadly Summer. There was a time, 40 years ago, when Eric was poised to become a bona fide leading man, after his powerful debut performance in Frank Pearson's 1978 King of the Gypsies, based on the book by Peter Maas. He next co-starred as Sissy Spacek's love interest in the 1981 drama Raggedy Man, followed by a scarifying performance 2 years later as the desperate bottom feeder Paul Snyder in Star 80, about the murder of Playboy model Dorothy Stratton. His compelling performance as a young would-be mobster in On the Make, playing opposite Mickey Rourke in The Pope of Greenwich Village, 1984, helped make that film a cult classic. His role as a runaway redneck, Buck McGee, in Andrei Konchalovsky's thrilling Runaway Train, brought him an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actor in 1986. The Golden Globes had already nominated him for Best Newcomer for King of the Gypsies, the movie that was going to change his life. Instead, his life changed him. So, what happened? At 61, he's considered a journeyman actor, not a star. His website introduces him as Eric Roberts, actor. But he's more than that, because he's also a legend. Dr. Rico Simonini can testify to that. Dr. Simonini is an eminent Los Angeles cardiologist, and he's also a working actor. He's producing an independent film, Frank and Ava, in which he plays Frank Sinatra, and Eric plays notorious Columbia Pictures mogul Harry Cohn. Simonini says that to many of the A-list actors he knows, such as Leonardo DiCaprio, Eric is a god. He's the man. I met with Roberts and his wife, Eliza Roberts, at the castellated Chateau Marmont on Sunset Boulevard. She and I watched Eric wade joyfully through the welcoming smiles of the servers, desk clerks, busboys, the whole chateau staff. He stopped to talk to them and share a joke, pausing in front of the large, ornate mirror at the hotel's entrance, where he stole a glimpse of himself. "Oh, God," he said, "Chris Walken and I coiffed ourselves in front of this mirror 40 years ago, and not one molecule of this place has changed." He loped once around the garden on his long, skinny legs to see if there was anyone he knew, but quickly came back into the nearly empty bar where his wife and I were waiting. Blue-eyed, auburn-haired Eliza is a casting director and actress. She played Brunella in Animal House and appeared in the 1976 remake of A Star is Born, who conveys warmth, strength, and brains. They met on an MGM Grand Airlines plane, seated next to each other. I had David Rayfield's, my biological father's, script, Intersection, on my lap, she recalls. Rayfield co-wrote the screenplays for 3 Days of the Condor, Round Midnight, and The Firm, among others. So, as soon as I was seated next to Eric, I was like, damn it, I didn't want to talk shop. But the Oscars had just happened, where Eric was nominated for Runaway Train, and Eric loved David's writing, so there were all these strange connections. But I thought he was probably gay, because he was very pretty and had a cat on his lap named Tender. They married 6 years later. Theirs is clearly a love match, but she's the first to say that Eric can be trouble. He's had the bad boy image from age 19 to 59, and still the crush-worthiness of him spans generations and genders. Like Christopher Walken, Eric can convey both menace and offbeat humor. Campbell says Eric has a keen sense for comedy, and he's not afraid to be utterly goofy on camera. Yes, he has played a lot of bad guys, but with our slightly comedic Stalked by My Doctor franchise, he gets to bring a little Jerry Lewis to the set. He gets to be funny and vulnerable. And what makes him great to work with, Campbell attests, is that Eric is very easy to direct. He's always there on time, and he's the fastest actor out of the makeup and wardrobe mill. He wants to be on set, and he wants to work. He likes acting, and he's there to play. He's genuinely happy to be working, and he truly is fun to be around. No ego, no vanity whatsoever. Very down to earth. So, again, given his love of the work, his dedication, his edgy beauty, his unmistakable talent, what happened? Why didn't he have the long-lived leading man career of, say, Tom Hanks? Harrison Ford, Leonardo DiCaprio, or Johnny Depp? Why did his sister Julia Roberts become one of the biggest stars in the world, and he didn't? Basically, there are two answers to that question. The first has to do with Eric's decades-long drug abuse. Now in the past, at one time it had a heavy impact on his life and work. Then there was the car accident that left him in a coma for 3 days, roughed up his face, and resulted in some neurological damage, overcome through months of therapy. Next, photos, Star 80s. Roberts, with director Bob Fosse on the set of Star 80, 1983. In the Pope of Greenwich Village, 1984. And with sisters Lisa and Julia, 1986. Celebrity rehab. The drug problem involved both cocaine and marijuana. I would go to meetings with people that mattered, like Oliver Stone and Sean Penn, he confesses, and I would go stoned. Woody Allen, I met him very stoned, and he dismissed me, as well he should have. I did that for about 10 years. The whole point being, I was asking for help, saying, you see where I'm at, now help me, because I'm worth helping. I get it now, I just didn't get it when I should have. Eric was doing a lot of coke, which at the time was running through Hollywood like a contagious rash. You'd arrive on the set in the morning, and they'd send you to the prop truck, where there'd be bowls of cocaine, Eric explains. Everybody from executives to craft service was doing cocaine. I was doing it to the point where my wife said, it's me or the coke. I did all the psychotropics. I got myself arrested in 1987 for possession of pot and cocaine and resisting arrest. I went back to pot. I've been a pothead all my life, with several sober breaks I refer to as binge sobriety. Though he had managed to end his cocaine addiction years before, in 2010, Eric entered the world of reality television by appearing on Celebrity Rehab with Dr. Drew. Which brings together a handful of known personalities who are struggling with substance abuse, usually the kiss of death for a working actor. Addressing his marijuana addiction, Eric appeared in season 4, along with former model and reality show regular Janice Dickinson, musician and former teen idol Leif Garrett, and Jason Davis, grandson of a former co-owner of 20th Century Fox, Marvin Davis. These shows are sanctioned voyeurism, Eliza says, but they jumped in anyway. Boy, did we get some flack. Everybody from family to his agents, they were like, you cannot do this. But a funny thing happened on the way out of rehab. Eliza called several producers and casting directors and asked if they stopped considering people who had appeared on shows like Celebrity Rehab. Across the board, everyone said, absolutely not. If anything, we look at them more supportively. We're going to vilify somebody for sharing their struggle? Instead of abandoning him, casting agents welcomed him. Some of the best shows he's done since Celebrity Rehab, says Eliza. And in a chart, Selected Filmography, 2017, choice roles from Eric Roberts' recent releases are highlighted below. He worked on more than 70 films last year. Induced Effect, Boss, The Matadors, CIA Director, The Summoning, Chief Lubbock, Surge of Power, Revenge of the Sequel, Auger, Unbridled, Roger Donegal, After School Special, Eric Roberts, The Terror of Hallows Eve, Ed, Actors Anonymous, Sonny, Devil Dogs, Colonel Armstrong, Lore, Sheriff, You're Gonna Miss Me, Lawrence Graves, Executor, Richard, Mascarmanos, Buelo Chino, Days of Power, Nick, Maximum Impact, Secretary of State Robert Jacobs, Never Saw It Coming, Wendell Garfield, Henri, Jenkins Chesney, and Almost Amazing, Zane. Where it all started. Eric Roberts was born in Biloxi, Mississippi, and grew up in Georgia. His parents ran a children's theater company, but they split up when he was 15 after a contentious marriage, which Eric remembered as a catastrophe. They were married for 16 years. It was very emotional, very loud. It was very much an I love you, F you marriage. After the divorce, his sisters, Lisa and Julia, lived in Smyrna, Georgia, with their mother, Betty, while Eric lived in Atlanta with his father, Walter. As a child, Eric suffered from horrible stuttering, not just once or twice, but every time I opened my mouth. For years, the whole class found it amusing. They would laugh, and it killed me. All these effing rednecks, you know. and they hated me when I was little, and it was a drag. Acting saved him. He found that when he memorized lines, he could speak without stuttering. He spent part of the summer of 1973 at London's Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. RADA. Only 17, he returned to Georgia, but a few years later he left for New York. There he lived at a YMCA and took classes at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. He found TV work on the soap opera Another World. I was the world's worst soap opera actor, Eric would remember later. He was fired partway through his first season. But Eric caught a lucky break when he met casting director Marion Doherty. She was the most successful, biggest, most famous, most career-changing, industry-changing casting director that's ever been, he says. She discovered Robert Redford. She made star after star after star. Having seen Roberts in a play at the American Academy, Doherty, along with Juliet Taylor, her young protege at Marion Doherty Associates, took Eric in and introduced him to the manager Bill Troisch, who represented Chris Walken and Sissy Spacek. He signed me the day I talked to him, Eric recalls. Never saw me work, but he took Marion and Juliet's recommendation and signed me. Got me my first movie, King of the Gypsies. In 1979, he got cast as the fiery young seminarian in Mass Appeal at the Manhattan Theater Club. In those days, one of the places Eric hung out was the Café Central on 75th and Amsterdam. It was kind of a hot spot for a lot of actors, musicians, ballet dancers, recalls the producer and actress Colleen Camp. Baryshnikov would be there, and Al Pacino and Robert De Niro, and a little later Mickey Rourke. Bruce Willis was the bartender. If someone was doing a play, they'd go to Café Central. That's where Colleen first met Eric. Later, when both were living in Los Angeles, she was impressed with how funny he could be. So she asked him, "Why aren't you doing comedy? You're freaking hilarious." King of the Gypsies. For his first film, Eric was thrown in among seasoned actors. Sterling Hayden, who was enjoying a resurgence after playing the crooked cop in The Godfather, Shelley Winters, and a young Susan Sarandon. "I was the only one who was a rookie in the whole cast," he explains. "I worked my ass off all night, got about 3 hours sleep from anxiety, get up, and go again. I was a 21-year-old kid who was scared to death. I walk in," he says, "I smell hashish very strongly. I see the smoke in the air. I smell it, and I recognize it. So I'm in this little trailer filled with hashish, and Sterling Hayden is smoking a pipe." The first thing Hayden said to Eric was, "Want to get high?" Eric demurred, explaining, "I can't work if I'm stoned. I don't talk well when I'm effed up." He goes, "You do get effed up, don't you?" I said, "On occasion." He says to me, "Okay, let's get down to business. What scene are we shooting tonight?" I said, "Scene 87. He says to me, "I don't give a shit about the effing number. What happens in the scene?" Eric answered, "It's kind of a pivotal scene, Mr. Hayden. I run away from home, and you've come to find me, and you have your thugs grab me and bring me back because you want to hand your kingdom to me, and not to your son." Hayden asked if Eric was good at improvisation, because that's what we're doing, and so they improvised the whole scene. "I felt like I was skydiving," Eric recalls, "but I had a parachute. I wasn't scared, but I was thrilled." After we worked together, Sterling said to me, "You're in for a big ride. They're going to try to get you to move to Hollywood. Do not do it." I was like, "Okay, okay," because he was adamant. Some years later, Eric would visit Hayden in his hospital room. He was dying of cancer, which is what had killed Eric's father. "I was probably more numb to it than I would have been otherwise because of watching my father die. So I never felt the pain, up until he said to me, 'Don't come back anymore.' I said, 'Why?' He goes, 'Because I need to die.' and then I started to feel the loss. High on cocaine, Eric had a horrific car accident in 1981. I was in a coma. My speech was very retarded. I had to learn how to walk again and talk again. It was really hard. Eric spent 2 months going to rehab every day, getting back in shape, but he continued to have short-term memory issues, not uncommon with brain trauma. He went back to work, hired to reprise his role as the seminarian in Mass Appeal on Broadway with Milo O'Shea, directed by Geraldine Fitzgerald. Because he had already performed it, he knew all the lines, but he and Fitzgerald disagreed about how to play his character. Eric quit the play before it opened. As a result, he says, she told everybody I wasn't healed from my car accident. The phone calls stopped. Nobody called Eric Roberts, except Bob Fosse, who said, I want you to come in and audition. Star 80. Eric feels that Bob Fosse saved his career. I got hip to Fosse as a kid when I watched Lenny, the 1974 movie about the controversial comedian Lenny Bruce, which I thought was the best movie I'd ever seen at the time. So I kept track of Bob Fosse because of that. But then he didn't make a lot of movies. Then I leave home, and I'm out in the world, and he does All That Jazz. Oh, my God. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.